During this portion of the argument, I will ask counsel to stay away from any classified references, and then, if necessary, we will seal the courtroom for any portion involving the classified material.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I'm August Flingy with the Justice Department and here on behalf of the United States. In this case, the district court's factual findings that after Salahi became a sworn al-Qaeda member, he continued to provide support to al-Qaeda and closely associate with several al-Qaeda operatives established as a matter of law that he never disassociated from al-Qaeda, but remained part of the group. In reaching the opposite conclusion, the district court made two important legal errors. The court failed to look at Salahi's activities and associations together with each other and together with the decision he made to join al-Qaeda to determine whether it was more likely than not that he had left the group. And the court erred by failing to put some burden on Salahi to establish that he dissociated from al-Qaeda after swearing bayat, a burden the court found that he had failed to meet because he had not acted to sever his ties. First,
before you get into those, I want to do what I did in the last case and make sure I completely understand the argument the government's making here. In the district court, the government argued that there were two bases for detention, that the petitioner aided the September 11 attacks and that he was part of al-Qaeda, right?
Initially.
Yeah. You abandoned the first claim, right, in the district court, and added that he could be detained because he personally and material supported al-Qaeda, correct?
Which, after the hearing, that argument was made in the district court.
Yeah. And the district court ruled against you on that.
Yes.
And you're not appealing that.
Yes, we haven't raised that issue.
Okay, so the only issue before us is whether he is part of. That's it.
That is the only issue.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay.
Did he remain part of al-Qaeda?
Yeah.
And when we would say, irrespective of the burden, what the court did here, by all but ignoring this decision to swear bayat and enduring loyalty to al-Qaeda, was to dissect the timeline of his activities in a way similar to the way the court in Adahi dissected the various pieces of evidence showing.
What's your response to, I want to ask your response to two things the district court said. One was, he said, the reason he didn't shift the burden of proof is because the petitioner swore bayat in 1991 at a time when the United States and al-Qaeda's interests in Afghanistan were identical. That is, both the U.S. and al-Qaeda were opposing the communist government of Afghanistan. And the district court ruled that, you know, al-Qaeda at the time of capture was a very different organization than it was at the time he swore bayat. And it's relevant, he says, but not for shifting the burden, right?
So the court said that in rejecting the government's legal argument that it should shift the burden. So it wasn't a factual finding, but it was sort of a method to analyze whether it was appropriate to shift the burden. We would say that is wrong under the laws of war.
Why?
The laws of war look to association with an organization or with a state military force. They don't ask about the motivation of the person who's in the force, and they don't ask about the motivation of the nation when they join the force.
Yeah, but you're talking about the hypothetical in your brief, right, about the German soldier?
Sure.
Yeah, you're totally right about that, but, you know, a German soldier who joins the German army in the 30s and is captured in 1943, that was your hypothetical, right?
Yes.
Of course you don't look into it, because there's absolutely no doubt in 1943 that a uniformed, armed German soldier is part of the German military.
Well, the only point we're trying to make is...
That's the question here. Is the petitioner at the time of capture still a member of al-Qaeda? And the district court found, as a matter of fact, that because he didn't disregard the bayat, he simply said because al-Qaeda is a very different organization at the time of capture than it was at the time of the oath, that that's not a justification for shifting the burden of proof.
Well, we would say it still makes sense to shift the burden of proof, and your question sort of reveals that, because after the oath, the entire question in the case turns to, did he remain part of al-Qaeda? And his first line of evidence is his claim in his declaration that he severed all ties.
Right.
Now, if he never came into court and never said he had severed ties from Al-Qaeda, presumably the government would easily win the habeas case. So the question must be, did he sever ties? And we would say he has to come forward with some showing, some meet some burden to show that. It doesn't matter when he joined Al-Qaeda.
You keep ignoring my question. I mean,
I'm trying to.
The only question is, the question you started talking about was the burden shifting. You said the district court erred by not shifting the burden. I was asking you, number one, how do you respond to his finding that he's not saying that the joining of the swearing of Baya is irrelevant. He's saying that it's not a basis for shifting the burden because Al-Qaeda's goals changed so dramatically between the time he joined and the time he was captured. And I've seen an answer to that. The other thing he said was the district court pointed out there's no way someone who's been detained in Guantanamo with no access to information for 8 years could possibly meet that burden of proof anyway.
Well, Your Honor, there is a simple way to meet that burden. It is to tell the court honestly what you've been up to. He said, and that's exactly what he tried to do in court. He said, look, I cut off all ties, and then he talked about his activities in the intervening period. And we suggest that if you look at the district court's specific findings about those activities in the intervening period, it does not support his claim to have cut off all ties. And the district court agreed with
that. That's fine. I mean, you know, you can argue the case that way. And
we're arguing it both ways.
Whatever way it takes.
Yeah. Okay, I just have to tell you, I still don't get your response to the point I've made about the district court's finding. It is a finding that the goals of Al-Qaeda changed, and it's a finding supported by historical fact. I mean, the fact is that at that time, it wasn't until after the first Gulf War when United States military forces were in Saudi Arabia that Osama bin Laden switched to calling for attacks on the United States.
As far as the record disclosed.
Yeah, right. Historically, his finding is well supported. So
the district court's finding on the nature of Al-Qaeda was off by many years. He said
I agree with you that the Al-Qaeda's hostility to the United States began occurring much earlier than you would know from the district court's opinion. But for purposes of this case, when he swore Bayat, the United States and Al-Qaeda had a common goal, destroying the communist government in Afghanistan. And it wasn't until the following year that Al-Qaeda began to change its mission, and it's that point that he said he disassociated. So the district court simply saying that's not enough to shift the burden to him. It's still the government's burden to show, using Bayat and anything else it wants, that he was part of Al-Qaeda.
Does the record here actually support the finding that Al-Qaeda's purposes were actually that narrow?
It doesn't. There wasn't much on that in the district court opinion. It was a one-liner in a footnote in rejecting a legal argument, so it didn't purport to be any sort of factual finding. And if you look at the 9/11 report, you can see that kind of bin Laden's focus on the U.S. was prompted by the Gulf War buildup in 1990. In early 1992, which is the same time Salahi was fighting for Al-Qaeda, bin Laden announced announced his intentions to rid the Gulf of U.S. forces. So there's certainly the district court's statement is not supported by the history of Al-Qaeda. More importantly, the need to shift the burden doesn't have to do with these intentions. And we would submit that the same analysis that you would apply in the German soldier situation should apply here. If someone has enlistment papers from 1936, you would not go and say, well, Germany was friends with the United States in 1936, and you wouldn't say, this guy loves America. You would look at whether that he had a discharge in between 1936 captured.
No, you wouldn't. And the reason you wouldn't is that under your hypothetical, he was captured in 1943, right, as a uniformed, armed member of the German military. There's no question that he's part of the German military.
Well, that part of the hypothetical...
And that's the question in this case.
You're addressing a different issue.
Yeah.
Well, the nature of al-Qaeda is different, and I agree. There's probably not a formal discharge from al-Qaeda, but that doesn't mean that he should have some obligation to show convincingly that he left the group. Instead, what the evidence here shows, enduring ties. He swore buyout, and then year after year after year, he is associating with high-level al-Qaeda.
He did testify that he had left.
Right.
Absolutely. He's trying to meet that burden.
He did try to meet that burden. And what is the review that we are making of the district court's decision if it has that evidence on the one side and the government's evidence on the other side?
Point one, I would say, is the district court did not accept as true his claim that he severed all ties. The district court said in that same footnote he never acted affirmatively to sever his ties, and that was his first line of argument. The second point, so what?
I mean, we would assume he would not act affirmatively to sever his ties. It's going to get him killed.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's going to get him killed. He doesn't have to prove that he went and told them, I'm quitting. His burden was, if he has one, would be to establish that he had withdrawn from al-Qaeda. His evidence is, he said, I withdrew from al-Qaeda. The government prevents, I'm not saying anything against the government's evidence. The government presents good evidence that he's not telling the truth, but the district court weighed it and came out the other way. So what is our review supposed to
be? I think we're really at the line between what is a clearly erroneous review and a legal review. I mean, mm-hmm. The court has said that whether he did X or Y is a factual finding for clear error review. But at the same time, the court said the import of him doing X, Y, and Z, and we have a lot of that here, because the district court found he maintained these associations,
Al-Qaeda is a mixed question of law and fact.
Yeah, so it's hard for me to say exactly where on the line this fits.
But the district court's finding wasn't that he remained part of it. It was that he was a freelancer, that he was a committed jihadist. I mean, that's why the district court looked at this. He said, look, this guy, he's a committed jihadist. We know that. And he used to be a member of al-Qaeda. He has a lot of al-Qaeda connections. And from time to time, he recruited, sent someone over to al-Qaeda, but he did it as a freelancer.
I think that's where we get right into the Adahi problem in this case, because by suggesting he's a freelancer completely ignores that he swore loyalty to the organization. Okay. If he swore loyalty and then is continuing to help them as al-Qaeda is turning against the United States, how can that not show a continued voluntary...
I understand that part of your argument. So we're now beyond the burden of proof. Let me ask you this. You argue, now Awad was decided after, was it decided after all the briefing or was it decided before your reply brief? I can't remember.
It was before our reply brief.
But after the
other brief.
Yeah. So I'm curious about your reaction to Awad. And my question relates to the command structure argument, right?
Yes, sure.
Awad looks different to me than this case. In Awad, the petitioner there traveled to Afghanistan right after September 11th, right? He traveled right after September 11th, and engaged in armed conflict against the United States and its allies. Okay, his name was on the list, which was discovered at this training camp. He joined this group of fighters who were barricaded in this hospital, right? Mm-hmm. And the district court or the court of appeals said, quote, these fighters treated Awad as one of their own. So it was in that context that we said, look, that's enough. You don't need any more evidence that he followed orders or commands. This was in and of itself enough. This case is totally different. The petitioner here was captured far from the battlefield, right? There's no allegation that he engaged in hostile activities against the United States. So in a case like this, the command structure argument might actually be useful, because it's a way of distinguishing as we said in Ben Asiyat, whatever that case is, distinguishing freelancers from people who are actually part of. One way you know someone like this might be part of Al-Qaeda if he's taking orders or operating within the command structure.
We know Al-Qaeda.
So so what I'm saying is, why doesn't the command structure, while it was inappropriate in Awad, still a perfectly appropriate way to analyze this case?
I think two responses.
Yeah.
One, when thinking about alternatives to showing one is in the command structure, alternative number one is formally joining the force. And that's what Bayat comprises.
Why don't we agree, for purposes of my question, we're going to set Bayat aside? Okay.
I don't think we can do that. That is not a fair way to analyze the evidence.
Well, since I'm asking the questions, okay, I get to decide. I'm not deciding the case. I'm just asking you a question. Okay, and there's no obligation that I ask all questions at once and consider them in their entirety.
Fair.
It's just a legal question I'm asking you about Awad. You make the argument that the command structure argument doesn't apply here. And we certainly did in Awad suggest it had problems. I'm only asking you whether or not, because of the different factual situations in these cases, it's not a useful way to think about the case along with everything else, okay?
Well, you mentioned about Awad. He was treated by the fighters as one of their own.
Right.
Salahi was treated by these high-level Al-Qaeda operatives as one of their own.
Yeah, but he didn't fight with them. He wasn't captured in Afghanistan.
Well, he fought with them initially and then continued to be treated as if he was one of them.
But
he traveled amongst them. He lived with Al-Qaeda cells.
But
he provided
recruits. Wouldn't it help to, if you're trying to prove that he's, quote, part of Al-Qaeda, what's wrong? Wouldn't it be a perfectly appropriate question, and wouldn't the government, in fact, try to argue that in what he was doing, his recruiting activities and all these other things, that he was, in fact, following orders?
Well, sure. That
okay.
is absolutely
of course,
one way to
right?
show.
All right. So isn't the absence of orders equally relevant?
I hate to get back to Bayat because you want me to ignore it, but Bayat is the best.
Why don't you accept, for purposes of the question, that I completely agree with you that the district court didn't adequately consider Bayat in his ultimate analysis, okay?
Okay.
Assume you win that argument, I agree with you.
And we would certainly want to point out indications that there are orders going on.
Okay, and wouldn't it be equally relevant that there weren't any in terms of whether he was part of?
It depends on the nature of the activity, I believe.
How can it possibly be relevant one way and not the other way? I mean, if you say it's relevant that he took orders to show that he's part of, how can you possibly then say it's inappropriate for the district court to point out that he didn't take orders?
I think that's a fair point.
Okay. All right, so we agree on that too now, right? Right? Can you give me an example? I want an example from you of a situation where someone is dealing with or cooperating with Al-Qaeda, okay, but not part of it. Can you give me any examples?
A completely independent contractor who was, I haven't thought a lot about that hypothetical.
Like,
but
well, like maybe someone who sells, say, cell phones, right?
I mean, Ben Saez.
And he sells cell phones
to
Al-Qaeda. Even if he knew Al-Qaeda was Al-Qaeda, he might be guilty of material support, right? But he's not part of.
I think that's that's a fair statement.
Okay. And what about, for example, a parent who allows an Al-Qaeda son to stay in their house for a couple
Absolutely.
Of nights?
Absolutely. That's an example from Garebi.
Right. Not part of, right? Yes or no?
I mean, I think you'd have to have more evidence.
Yeah. And suppose someone, sets up a website for information about cyber attacks and learns that Al-Qaeda members are, checking out his website and doesn't take it down. Is that person part of?
I hate to comment on that. I mean, here, Salahi was setting up a website, and when an Al-Qaeda operative said, "You better shut that down, there's surveillance concerns," he shut it down. I mean, that suggests, first, it suggests there's an order coming out. Well, I mean, it might not look like a military order, but
you've got a district court finding on that doesn't help you.
No, that's not true. The finding by the district court was this project didn't materialize. It didn't materialize because of the Al-Qaeda order. That's a helpful finding. That suggests he was following directions. That was in the year 2000, very close to 9/11. And that involved this Gansarsky guy, who is a known Al-Qaeda member. So we know this was tied to Al-Qaeda. So I don't think that the district court finding on that
I don't think the district court, I'm just looking at this, the district court did not find that he did it under orders.
He said he stopped.
Find one way or the other.
He halted it at Gansarsky's request.
Right, but he didn't find it was pursuant to orders.
Well, I mean, we're not going to find military-style orders with Al-Qaeda. That's pretty close.
That is
pretty close. And I think if you
see, that's my point. The point here is that, you know, these are facts. And you're disagreeing with the inferences the district court drew from the facts. But, you know, ultimately we face a question of law. But when the district court doesn't make a finding one way or another about whether he took that down pursuant to orders, we can't conclude that he did.
Well, we would.
I mean, I know your inference is that he did, but the trier of fact didn't make that inference.
I mean, I think you can in one circumstance because Salahi himself testified at trial that is why he took it down, and he said it was concerns about quote surveillance. He agreed there was concerns about surveillance that led Gansarsky to tell him that he should stop. That's at JA 2639. But beyond that, I mean, another response to that is the district court didn't find there were not orders, and the district court in other places where it found that there were not orders does not look at Bayad. It separates the activities from Bayad. And that first point.
I told you, for purposes of all this, you can accept the idea that I agree with you on that.
He has two other judges he can be talking to while he's saying all these
things.
Exactly. Go ahead.
I want to get back to this command structure discussion for a moment. On the one hand, you say that no longer applies because after Awad, we've said you don't have to show that. But you also say, but whether he was receiving orders is not irrelevant.
Sure.
Is there anything inconsistent about those positions? In other words, could someone receive orders and not be part of the command structure of the organization?
I doubt it. I mean, I think if you're getting orders and following through, you're definitely part of it. As Chief Judge Santel said, sufficient but not necessary in the Awad opinion. And, you know, I want to point out Salahi himself said at his CSIRT statement that Bayat was a direction to, quote, take orders and follow Osama bin Laden. That is a pretty powerful evidence that the Bayat means something in an ongoing way. It means that when he's doing stuff to help Al-Qaeda, it is likely just someone carrying out their duties to the group as a sworn member. And I think there's another...
So is your argument that the command structure standard is no longer necessary, but that it was met here?
Certainly. We certainly think it was met here because of the nature of Bayat as suggesting that the things he's doing to help Al-Qaeda are within the command structure. He is a part of the force, so when he's taking actions to help the force,
show it's within the command structure. However, when you can show it, that does carry your case.
It certainly helps our case. And you know, Abu Haas...
If you actually could show it and conclusively that he was in command structure, you've won your case on that point, right?
Sure. Abu Haas, who is an Al-Qaeda leader, and asking him to help Mr. al-Awlaki get around Germany, another Al-Qaeda leader, that strongly suggests that there are orders along to help him and that they come from Al-Qaeda because these are two Al-Qaeda leaders.
The district court's findings don't help you on that.
Well, the district court kind of dismissed the evidence, but didn't...
No, it didn't. He evaluated all the evidence and drew inferences from that event differently from the ones you wish to draw, and those inferences are the ones we're reviewing here. If they're clearly erroneous, fine, but You don't say they are.
Well, we're willing to win on a clearly erroneous standard.
Okay. One last question. If we agree with you that the district court that the district court's opinion has problems under these later decided cases like Awad and the one that requires the evidence to be looked at in its entirety, I assume the answer is what you're looking for is a remand, right?
We would be happy with a remand. Yeah. We do think the facts that were found by the district court show as a matter of law that he remained part of al-Qaeda, that someone who swore loyalty and continued to closely associate and provide support to al-Qaeda is still in al-Qaeda. And that is the district court's finding. The district court found there was continuing support, and the district court found there were close associations with numerous al-Qaeda operatives. And if you look under those, the types of support, and in particular the recruiting, is the type of thing that would make someone part of the force.
Is the United States conceding that the preponderance standard is required, or are you merely accepting that it's likely to be applied?
We think the preponderance standard is appropriate.
You understand.
And it's,
you've read what Judge Randolph has written in the past, that a standard less than preponderance might be applicable in.
We're conceding preponderance standard.
You are conceding preponderance standard, okay.
No further questions.
May it please the court, Teresa Duncan appearing on behalf of the petitioner appellee Muhammadu Old Salahi. In this appeal, the government is arguing against rulings the district court never made and ignoring the rulings it did make. Recognizing the weakness of its case and the correctness of the trial court's decision, the government also misrepresents the record and the district court's factual findings, ignoring the substantial deference to which those factual findings are due. Judge Robertson held 4 days of hearings in this case, heard 2 days of testimony, including a day and a half by Mr. Salahi, who testified by video conferencing from Guantanamo, so that Judge Robertson was able to watch him as he testified and assess his credibility.
Was the court properly assessing the evidence when it treated the government's evidence as being, viewing the government's evidence with something like skepticism?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court was doing what all of the district courts have done in these Guantanamo Bay cases, and that is refusing to give the government a presumption of reliability.
He didn't say he was refusing to give them a presumption of reliability. He went beyond that, didn't he?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe he did.
What did he mean by that phrase, then, that he was viewing it with something like skepticism?
That he was,
it sounds as if he is downgrading the evidence before he ever hears it, like the government has some other burden to overcome besides preponderance.
He was refusing to consider the government's evidence without skepticism. And when you look at in his opinion, at the place where he mentions, I'm applying my judicial skepticism to this evidence, he's weighing the credibility of different types of evidence from different places and giving them the weight that he thinks it deserves. So in his application of
that. That's not what he said, though. He said that he was viewing it with something like skepticism, and he said it twice, I think, didn't he?
Correct, Your Honor. He did say it twice. He said it at the very beginning, and I think there he's talking about not accepting the government's evidence without skepticism, which...
That's two different things, to say not accepting it without skepticism, saying I'm applying skepticism to it. I mean, he didn't say he was going to apply skepticism to... the petitioner's evidence.
But Your Honor, he did apply skepticism to our evidence. If you read in his footnote, his treatment of Dr. Iacopino's testimony shows the application of judicial skepticism. So I think Judge Robertson
did... What did he say about skepticism in that footnote?
He doesn't say the word skepticism,
no,
Your Honor, but when you read through his analysis of Dr. Iacopino's testimony, he's applying judicial skepticism.
He didn't believe all of it, right?
That's correct. That's skepticism.
That doesn't mean he's applying skepticism. It means he didn't believe all of it.
But it's applying skepticism. Applying skepticism is a way of analyzing evidence. If you accept evidence without skepticism, it's saying whatever is written on this page, I accept. And to apply skepticism to it.
Why did he bother saying this unless he's applying some different level of skepticism?
Well, Your Honor, in Awad, he said it a different way. He said that he would assess the evidence credibility line by line, that he would look for internal corroboration.
Yeah.
So he references
Awad. That's not what he said here. He didn't say, I'm going to treat this the way I normally treat evidence, weighing it and looking for internal inconsistencies. He said, I'm treating it with skepticism.
He does say that, Your Honor, but I think when you read the opinion in total and you read the way that he has approached the other two cases in which he denied the opinions, the skepticism is...
Can we look at those other two cases?
I think that they informed to the extent that he incorporated Awad into this opinion, so clearly you can look at his analysis there. But when you look at his approach to the three Guantanamo cases he's decided, and when you incorporate Awad into this opinion, that skepticism is not a higher burden. It's merely a way of approaching the government's evidence, and it is consistent with the way that the other district courts have approached the government's evidence and the way this court has
approached. Of the other district courts use that phrasing that I'm approaching the government's evidence with skepticism?
Your Honor, I don't recall if any other judge
has ever approved that formulation.
Not the word skepticism, but in Bensaya, this court did look at the government's evidence with some skepticism and asking whether some, you know, outside evidence corroborated evidence at issue in that case, which is not accepting the government's exhibit at face value, but rather approaching it, making your own credibility determinations of whether the evidence under the totality is reliable.
But he has to make credibility determinations on all evidence in all cases.
Correct.
But he normally would not say, all right, I'm going to look at your evidence, but I'm treating it with skepticism. He's doing something, or seems to be saying that he's doing something different here than he does in a run-of-the-mill case.
Well, I would agree with you to some extent, but it's not imposing a higher burden on the government. It's recognizing the unique nature of this evidence, that the government relied exclusively on interrogation reports in its case, and particularly interrogation reports of Mr. Slahi, after admitting that Mr. Slahi was subjected to...
I'm not sure where we crossed the line into classified.
Your Honor, I promise you that
okay,
I know
good.
That line, and I'll
Be
honor
careful.
It,
good.
I promise. That the circumstances under which Mr. Slahi made the statements on which the government relied were, I mean, the government has admitted in public reports and in public pleadings that what we would call it torture, they would call it coercive circumstances. But nonetheless, that those circumstances, as Judge Robertson found, rendered all of Mr. Slahi's statements to interrogators suspect. Given those circumstances, given the nature of the evidence in this case where we don't always know who the declarant is, we don't know what the circumstances, under what circumstances statements were made, evidence was gathered, judicial skepticism is really just a means of assessing the reliability of evidence under this unique circumstance of the Guantanamo cases. And when you read his opinion as a whole, it's clear that he's not holding the government to a higher standard. He's properly applying the preponderance of the evidence standard, but figuring out a way where you have conflicting accounts, where things aren't corroborated, to give the particular pieces of evidence and the government's ultimate showing the weight it deserves.
I'm sorry, were you doing that? I have a couple of questions. I hear what you're saying about fact-finding and our obligations to review that on the appropriate standard. I have a couple of questions about the legal standards the district court applied that I'd like to ask you. You're familiar with our opinion in Bensaya, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where we say that the determination must be made on a case-by-case basis with a functional rather than a formal approach, right?
Correct.
And of course, you're familiar with Awad. So, and you heard my questions about why I think, at least I think, Awad and why I think the command structure approach may still have relevance in a case like this, okay? But my question has to do with how the district court applied it here. Let me just give you an example or two. When he's talking about recruiting, and we can stay away from classified stuff here, he says he's talking about the detainees, the petitioner's statements about recruiting. He says, in none of those statements did he say he was tasked to do so, that is, to do the recruiting, tasked. Nor did he provide detail about any specific recruiting mission he was given, okay?
Correct.
So is this really consistent with Awad? I mean, what he's looking for is, and there's more examples. Let me just give you one other, and then you'll see my point. He's talking about the most damaging evidence against the petitioner here is these things he did with his brother-in-law, who was close to Osama bin Laden, right? And then he says none of these events or incidents has been shown to have happened within the command structure, right?
Right.
Okay, so under Awad and Bensai, it seems to me that while that's certainly one question, it's important to know whether, you know, there was an explicit order or something was carried out within the command structure. Don't you think it's possible that if you take those cases, what those cases are about, that the district court should also have been asking, well, maybe there aren't any explicit orders, but the petitioner's behavior over these period of years, his recruiting and all these other things, although there were no specific orders, it was such that it was pretty obvious that there was a formal relationship. In other words, it was happening so regularly and there was so much activity that even if there wasn't an order, he wasn't really a freelancer. It was a formal relationship, and he could be considered part of Al-Qaeda.
Your Honor, I'll treat each of those facts differently, but within that analysis. When you look, Judge Robertson recognized that the test for determining whether a person is part of Al-Qaeda is a flexible and functional test. He adopted the Judge Bates's decision in Hamlili, which also recognizes it's not formal but more of a functional test.
Yeah, but in each of these examples I gave you, it's not flexible. He's looking for actual functioning within the command structure.
And his approach to those particular facts makes sense under the circumstances. With respect to recruiting, the allegation of recruiting, the record below indicates that Mr. Salahi was a member of the broader jihadi community.
Right.
As you discussed earlier with respect to Afghanistan in 1991, there were jihadi community in Bosnia and Chechnya, which is separate and different from Al-Qaeda, as the judge specifically found below. So in the evidence is ambiguous about the nature of conversations that he would have had with people about his experiences in Afghanistan or about the jihadi movement in general, so that Judge Robertson needed to apply a framework for determining, is this, as Mr. Salahi testified, simply not recruiting, maybe talking to people about his experiences, but not recruiting for Al-Qaeda, or is it recruiting for Al-Qaeda? And the judge applied the command structure.
Right, but my question is, did he ever, given that we hadn't yet decided Awad, did he ever ask the question whether, even if there aren't formal orders or formal commands, that the petitioner's behavior over a period of years could still be viewed as part of Al-Qaeda? And he didn't ask that question.
Right.
And are you telling me that question is that he did ask it, or that he didn't, and he didn't ask it because it's inappropriate?
Your Honor, I can't speak for Judge Robertson whether...
No, we can only look at his order. I'm asking you where
right.
in his
and,
opinion
and I
he
think
did it.
In his
right?
order, I think that he did apply sort of a functional approach to the evidence. I think that, you know, that the command structure test made sense where the evidence was ambiguous, where it was open to two different interpretations.
No. My question is, I'm with you that at least speaking for myself, that the command structure test still makes sense in a case like this. My question is whether, given Awad and Bensaya, the opinion here applies it in a formalistic way that's too formalistic. I mean, even his conclusion, you said, well, he was just looking at that fact, but look at his conclusion. He says, I'm at page 20 at 280 under conclusion. He says, the government had to show that the support petitioner provided from time to time was provided within Al-Qaeda's command structure.
Correct.
And do you think that after Awad and Bensai is a correct statement of the law? Or do you... Well, why don't you answer that question?
Well, clearly under Bensai and Awad, it's no longer the law that the court had to make that specific
exactly.
finding.
So don't we really need to remand this now for the district court to look at this under the proper test? I mean, and look, these cases were decided after he wrote his opinion. So, you know, we all understand that. But now the law is pretty clear. And why doesn't this have to go back?
Because under the court's factual findings, Your Honor, even if you apply a more functional test and you, the evidence still doesn't lead up to the finding by preponderance of the evidence that Mr. Salahi was part of al-Qaeda. As Judge Robertson found, from, you know, for the last year and a half when Mr. Salahi was living in Mauritania, there was no evidence of a connection between him and the members of al-Qaeda in a support role. And we can talk more about that later. But even under the record as it exists, there's no need to remand because it's still those factual findings when given.
Well, what about the government's argument about al-Adahi, our decision in al-Adahi, and their argument that the district court here too often looked at the evidence in isolation and didn't step back and look at it all in its entirety?
Your Honor, the government looks...
You know, the conditional probability standard.
Correct, Your Honor. The government looks at one statement by Judge Robertson late in his opinion and ignores the rest of the opinion. When you, at the very beginning, Judge Robertson summarizes all of the government's allegations against Mr. Salahi. He devotes two full pages to a timeline summarizing the allegations against Mr. Salahi.
That's true.
He, throughout the opinion, he builds on the evidence and views that evidence as a whole in connection to each other. The part where the government focuses and argues that he committed the error of Adahi is where Judge Robertson is addressing the government's argument that aside from what Mr. Salahi may or may not have done, the fact of his association with so many people that the government alleges are al-Qaeda is a reason for finding him as part of al-Qaeda.
Independently.
Yeah. Because by the time Judge...
No, but that's the word the judge used. That's exactly what we said in you know which case I mean.
I know what you mean.
Don't hold any of us.
That's exactly what we said in the conditional probability case that he can't do.
Right.
You can't look at a piece of evidence and say this evidence independently is insufficient to hold him.
But by the time Judge Robertson makes that statement independently, he has already analyzed in toto the connections between Mr. Salahi and these individuals, what the government has alleged Mr. Salahi did, which we countered with evidence that he did not, and has looked at that evidence as a whole. And so here the government or the court is simply looking at, just given the fact of the relationships, having determined that, you know, recognized, for example, that there's the accusation that Mr. Salahi sent money or helped his cousin get money to his family in Mauritania, having looked at that, is the mere fact that he has a connection with his cousin sort of divorced from that enough to make him al-Qaeda? No. And when you get to the very end of Judge Robertson's opinion, he again summarizes all of the evidence.
Well, I'm not sure he does, and you just got to my next question. I'm looking at the same part of the opinion you are, page 280, right? And my question is prompted by the government's argument that, assume for purposes of this question, by the way, that I completely agree with you about not shifting the burden of proof, okay? But still, swearing by it is relevant to the ultimate decision, correct? You agree with that, okay. And do you see any evidence in this opinion that once the district court rejected the government's argument about shifting the burden, that he still kept the importance of swearing by'at on the table?
Yes, Your Honor. Uh-huh. He did consider the fact of by'at for what it was.
Well, look at page 280. You wanted to talk about the conclusion, okay? Here's what the court says. This is his conclusion. The government has shown that the petitioner, that Sly is an al-Qaeda sympathizer, perhaps a fellow traveler, that he was in touch with al-Qaeda members, and that from time to time he provided sporadic support, right?
Members of al-Qaeda.
Yeah. No mention of swearing by. In other words, when he got down to the bottom line about his judgment here, he didn't seem to have taken account of the fact that he swore. Now, maybe the proper finding would have been, look, I've taken account of by'at. He did swear it, but the fact is it was pre-92. I think it's of little value. And, you know, he was a freelancer, and that's not sufficient to be part of it. that might have been a perfectly defensible decision that would have survived an appeal. But since he didn't say that, we don't know what he would think if our decision in Al-Adahi had been decided, and it was so clear at the time he wrote this opinion that he clearly had to consider Bayat in the context of his final conclusion. We just don't know what he would have done.
Well, Your Honor,
and we can't make that judgment for him, can we?
Well, Your Honor, we do know.
How do we know?
If you continue on in his conclusion,
yeah.
In the next paragraph, he says, he acknowledges that Salahi fought with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan 20 years ago.
Right.
That he was part of Al-Qaeda 20 years ago. So right. He does include that in his mm-hmm. overall analysis of the
facts. He fought with Al-Qaeda. He did not reference the oath of Bayat.
He doesn't specifically say.
He doesn't say.
He does not specifically
lose
say
the Bayat. Lose the specifically. He doesn't say anything about the oath of Bayat, does he, in that conclusion?
But I think that he does not say the word Bayat, Your Honor. But the time that Mr. Salahi fought with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, I mean, that is a central fact to that Mr. Salahi.
It's a fact. And then one of the other facts is when he fought with them, he had also sworn Bayat to them.
That's correct. And
he did not reference that fact in this conclusion, did he?
He doesn't say the word Bayat.
He doesn't say anything about the oath at all, does he? Now, counsel, you can't change the record.
I'm not trying to change the record, okay. Your Honor, but I'm trying to explain what the record supports in terms of the fighting with Al-Qaeda.
And that record is that in this opinion, in the conclusion, he does not make any reference in any fashion to the oath of Bayat, right?
He does not mention the word.
He does not make any reference to that oath at all, does he? Yes or no? Don't tell me anything but yes or no. Then you can explain, but first have to say yes or no. Does he make any reference to that oath in any fashion in that conclusion?
I would say yes, Your Honor.
All right, tell me where it is. Read it to me.
Okay.
Read me the part about that oath, counsel.
In where he says Salahi fought with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, there was testimony below by Mr. Salahi.
That's your best answer to that question?
Well, let me tell you what Mr. Salahi testified. He testified.
Never mind what Salahi testified. We're talking about what's in this conclusion at this point. Counsel, you can admit that it's not in there.
I admit the word is
okay.
Not there,
Your Honor. No. Admit that there is no reference at all to that oath in there. It's not there, counsel, is it?
But it's implicit in the fighting with Afghanistan, Your Honor, because Mr. Salahi testified below that he swore Bayat in order to fight with Al-Qaeda against the communists in 1991, that he could not have fought had he not.
Are those not two different facts, swearing the oath and fighting?
Not on the record as it stands below.
Those are two different facts.
They are, but they're connected facts.
Those are two different facts.
They're different but connected.
And he finds one of them. Counsel, please don't try to defend a record you don't have.
I do have this record, though, Your Honor. I mean,
you have you're stuck with the record you've got, and he doesn't make any reference to that in here.
I acknowledge that he does not explicitly.
Thank you, counsel.
Can I? Oh.
You could have saved a lot of time if you'd done that sooner.
My last question. So we have an interesting situation here. We have a situation where we're reviewing a district court decision that was decided shortly before three really important opinions of this court about how to review these cases, right? It's pre-Awad. It's pre-Bin Saya, which makes it very clear that that we need a not a formal but a flexible approach, right? And we also have Al-Adahi, right, which makes it clear that you have to look at it all together. So why wouldn't it make sense for an appeals court in this situation, even though we may think that the district court under the law at that time, you know, may, let's assume you're right, pretty much got it right. Wouldn't it make sense for purposes of the consistency of our decisions to send it back for a fresh look at the record under these new decisions so that we have consistent decision-making about the handling of these habeas cases as possible? What's wrong with doing that?
Your Honor, the record, the opinion as it stands and the record as it stands fits well, snugly within those later three opinions.
Well, assume I don't agree with you about that. I know that's what you think, and that's what I'd argue if I were you, too. But let's assume I don't agree with you, okay? And you've heard my questions about all three of these cases, about Awad and Al-Adahi. And if that's my view, which I understand you don't agree with, wouldn't it be appropriate for the appeals court to ask the district court to take another look under these standards so that we have the decisions? You know, we have a lot of district courts deciding lots of detainee cases. And the only way we're going to get consistency here to have all the detainees treated equally under the same legal principles is to make sure that when we have a situation like this, where we do have three new decisions with three new sets of principles, that it's reevaluated under them. Now, what's the matter with that?
Your Honor, I mean, there's nothing legally the matter with it. I think, I mean, as you recognize, I think it's unnecessary. It also is essentially means starting from scratch, given Judge Robertson's retirement from the bench.
Well, we have a big record, and it might be necessary to hear some more evidence. But the point is, we would then have a decision, and it still might come out your way, because you're confident that it meets those standards. We would have a decision that meets the D.C. Circuit's most recent standards, and then we'd be sure also that this detainee will be treated the same way as other detainees by other district courts. See what I mean?
I understand what you're saying. I mean, we would ask the court to first consider under Judge Robertson's factual findings and giving them the deference to which they're due. And under those three cases, it's our position, of course, that we win.
I understand.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor.
Yeah. But you get my point, right?
I do understand
your
point.
Okay.
In your exchange with the Chief Judge, you said that these facts were connected, Bayat and fighting in Afghanistan. But is it the case that every al-Qaeda sympathizer who fought in Afghanistan had to swear Bayat?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. What I know is that Mr. Sahi testified below that he swore Bayat because he understood if he didn't, he wouldn't be able to fight with al-Qaeda against the communist government in 1991. That was his understanding of the oath.
Okay. If there's no further questions, I realize rebuttal would be in order, but do we need to have a classified session?
I don't think so.
Right now, it doesn't sound like it.
Dennis?
Do you think we need a classified session? Okay, let's go directly to rebuttal then, unless one of counsel wishes to ask us to go into classified session. We have ruled that we will go into it if it's needed. But
Your Honor, may I consult with my co-counsel?
Okay. We'll go ahead and have a rebuttal then, and then you can consult. I was thinking we might not go into rebuttal. We'll go ahead and go into rebuttal, and then you can consult. Come ahead, counsel.
May it please the court, I just want to take one last stab at burden shifting. Judge Taylor, you expressed concern about how the nature of al-Qaeda has changed, and we would say that is certainly relevant to whether Salahi has shown convincingly that he left the group, that and things like the passage of time and absence of al-Qaeda associations. But it's not a reason not to shift the burden as a legal matter. Once we have shown him to be a formal member of the group, and I think at any point in time it would be there's some obligation for him to come and say, look, no, actually, I've left. I'm doing other things now, and I'm no longer in the group. And here we don't have that.
Are you contending that he had to formally go to al-Qaeda and tell him he quit?
Absolutely not. There are, I think, a number of ways you can...
I misunderstood what you just said then.
No, he's telling the court I've left the group. He's not telling al-Qaeda.
Well, he did tell the court that he quit the group.
Yeah, and that's what
he meant that part.
Yeah. We submit the court didn't really buy that completely. And, you know, he continued to voluntarily affiliate, and that's the words from Ben Saya, with al-Qaeda as al-Qaeda issued its fatwa against Americans. And after that fatwa,
arguing this on your rebuttal because you think you need to shift the burden to win this case?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I mean, shifting the burden is sort of a small piece. I mean, I think effective...
Is that really proper rebuttal, even?
Sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah. Unless my colleagues have further questions, I think your time is now expired, and I'll give everybody one more chance to ask us to go into classified session.
Your Honor,
I'm sorry. I don't hear well.
Your Honor, we don't see the need to go into a classified session.
All right, thank you, counsel. It doesn't seem to me we need it, so we'll submit the case and take recess.